Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage. Remember, we con when you can't.
Yeah.
The collective groan in agreement.
True.
Come here so we can play.
All right, we got a pretty full house. I think we're going to kick it off. Welcome to the Advanced World Building Seminar, brought to you by Global Press, I guess. This is our 201 World Building Seminar, where we're going to address a few topics beyond the how do I start world building? My name is Wolfgang Bauer. I am the publisher at Cobalt Press. I've been doing this RPG stuff since since the TSR days, a while. But world building wasn't always my thing. That's more the last 5 to 10 years with Cobalt Press. Before then, I was playing in other people's worlds. And with me are Anna Meyer, who is a cartographer Cobalt Press and does work like this that you can come see at our booth. You want to tell people a little about your start in cartography?
Yeah, I started gaming in 79-80, so I'm also an old school gamer, so to speak, and then I didn't have time to be. I was part owner of a game store, so I was always been very geeky, and I didn't understand the fact that women shouldn't do this so back then, because I was back in Sweden, so I had no idea about it, but I played on. But then I moved to California 5 years ago, and then I decided to kind of finish my huge Greyhawk map that I was working on. So I started, now I'm able to do this full time. So I did, and then Wolfgang contacted me. I was Emmy nominated, and I've gone from there, so to speak. So now I sit and do stuff like this full time. So, yeah.
Great stuff. And also with me is Dan Dillon.
I'm Dan Dillon. I'm a freelance game designer and writer. Do most of my work these days through Cobalt Press, but I've also contributed to a couple of core Pathfinder books, a smattering of other third-party publishers, Rogue Genius, Legendary, and worked with a lot of great people.
Yeah. So that's us. We're going to tackle, I think, about three topics, and then we might take a question for people's problems. I want to ask, first of all, so how many of you have done your own world building already? I'm sort of assuming mostly everyone. Yeah. Pretty much everybody. Good. This is the right audience. And how many of those bits of world building, how many of you have published world building credits? Yeah? Three? Okay.
Not
some.
Yet.
But others headed that way. Okay. Some of what we'll talk about is more geared toward home campaigns and expanding your own world building for your benefit and that of your players. We might address publishing your world a little bit, but that's not the main focus here. Should we start with cartography, or should we start with 10 kinds of elves? Let's start with 10 kinds of elves.
I think we're more excited about that. Let's do it.
Yeah. So, my examples are going to be Midgard, Galarian, the Realms, Al-Kadim, because that's the stuff I know. And one of the inevitable problems I've run into with Midgard in particular is that over time, you may find a tendency to just increase the number of humanoid playable races in your campaign. I always start out with human, dwarf, elf, and then whatever players request. But in the case of Midgard, we had 5 or 6 races when we started, and 5 years later, I think I can name probably 18. They're not all flavors of elf the way the realms do it.
Sure.
But you want to describe the problem in the realms? We talked about this earlier.
Okay, yeah, I mean, so you take your standard D&D settings, Greyhawk, Forgotten Realms, and I want you to just think about, when you say elf, how many sub-races of elf are there? In the Forgotten Realms.
Many.
Gold elf, moon elf, you know, dark aquatic. Elf, aquatic, wild, wood. Wood and wild are different. Not the same. Gray, high, you know.
And
winged.
The urge to do this is pretty natural, right? You're a world builder. You're like, I need to put some elves out on the plains here. They need to be running elves with a wind culture, and they're not foresty, and I'm just going to make a whole new race of elves because my campaign is there, and I need some elves. Or, you know, this forest elf is different from that forest elf because reasons.
Multiple different forest elves.
Yeah.
Elf seems to be the one that suffered from that.
But than other more places. Than dwarves,
yes,
yes.
More
than gnomes.
More monolithic and, yep.
And I mean, the problem is larger. It's, eventually, you just get so many base humanoids that when you get a new player into your campaign, they ask, so what can I play? Or they have an idea what they can play. And you kind of have to give them the binder, like, you know, anything in this book except Y, anything in this book except X. It's a problem only in that eventually it kills your suspension of disbelief and it starts to make your world seem like a loosely affiliated set of humanoid tribal conglomerate. It fragments your setting. My argument in the Kobold Guide to World Building, which I have to wave around at least three times during the seminar, so that was one.
Bylaws.
Is that the less races you have, the more interesting each of them can be.
Right.
You've all done world building, you're all running campaigns. How many of you are using like just humans or just humans, dwarves, and elves? Is anybody keeping it down to... I'm very impressed. This is not a problem for you. We're not solving a problem for you. All right. How many people have at least three flavors of elf in their campaign? Really?
No.
Oh my god. Maybe this is just a problem in my campaign and Ed Greenwood's campaign.
Just
to
be there's
no elves. Talislanta said
yeah.
No elves.
Yeah.
All right. Well, how many people have allowed in races they don't like, but the player begged and pleaded? Yeah, that's
yeah,
really
yeah,
yeah, yeah.
First
off, yeah, me too.
Yeah, me too. Why did I say that? They really, really want to play. I think it's only a problem if that one player eventually spawns entire nations and conflicts and things that are messing up the narratives you were hoping for in the first place, right? Someone so desperate to play the lizard folk that you have to invent an entire dinosaur empire.
Exactly.
Maybe you've gone too far. Right? But all right, maybe that's not our biggest problem in advanced world building. What were our other two? Death of Gods. All right.
Changing your pantheon.
Yeah, changing your pantheon. This seems to happen, and again, I'm going to point at the realms, but I think you'll see it in Galarian and elsewhere. New gods arise, old gods need to go away. There's this tendency in world building to say, I just want to mess with the pantheon because I made a mistake a while ago,
right?
Or I need this new spin.
Spell plague every 50 years.
How many of you have tried to pull off a really big event like Death of Gods or the Meteor Strike? Or the demonic invasion. And I call it Death of Gods, but it's really all of the...
Any world-shaking cataclysms.
World-shaking cataclysms.
Yeah.
Now, are you talking about while the campaign's going on or predates the campaign?
No, I'm talking mostly like while it's going on. Like,
right.
Predates is, oh yeah, the elves all died of pneumonia, and that's why I don't allow elves in my game.
Now, that's completely different. That's backstory of a setting, backstory of a game.
Right, but it's like, I dropped a meteor on the old capital city because I was tired of it, or the players, you know, called the meteor strike with mythic enhancements. I actually like the big campaign shaking events. I just think if you do more than one a campaign,
right.
Nobody buys the second one.
Right. So at some point, you've spent that particular nickel. So you have to make sure that there's a tendency of a campaign setting or a game to escalate. You know, that's just the very nature of particularly Pathfinder and any level-based system. Things ramp up as you go, right? Everything gets more challenging, everything gets bigger, the spells make more boom. So at some point, obviously, you're going to be saving the entire multiverse, right?
Obviously, Yeah, okay. Pretty clearly, in most hero campaigns,
right? There's wiggle room, but you have to be careful that as you're moving up to that, you know, 18th, 19th, 20th level challenge, that your campaign world, if it's going to ongo and if it's going to particularly host multiple campaigns, especially with the same players, you have to be careful that you're not burning yourself out on that particular currency. How many demon invasions can you have that change the face of your world before it's just like, okay, well, why does anyone live in this hellhole anymore?
Sandpoint.
Poor Sandpoint.
Poor Sandpoint.
All of Planescape.
Come on,
all
of Planescape. Well, that's kind of the deal going in.
That's the deal going in. You knew there were demons going in.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, those big events, I think, are great fun for the players and for the game master if handled well, but don't do more than one. The sort of approach I like to take to them is put them toward the end of the campaign or put them toward the beginning of the campaign, because if it's the demonic invasion on day one, you've set the tone for the entire campaign.
I have an idea.
Midgard's full. But all right.
We can create some area somewhere. Undefined areas.
We do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, okay. Earth-shattering events. How did it go for you guys? How many of you would do it again? Right?
Okay.
How many of you said, yeah, I think I need to change up how I changed the entire world? Did it go sort of sideways on anybody? A couple? The hands aren't raised as high for these.
Yeah, fair enough.
I've had some.
I guess finally you get consistency issues when things get out of hand.
Right.
Yeah.
I think these sort of spell plague, meteor strike, demonic impact things are actually a solution to one of the topics we're going to bring to this. The big campaign changing, I want to shake it up, the Game Master is bored type events can be a beautiful way to solve what I call cartographic regrets, which is, I've drawn the world map, and I am pleased. I am most pleased. I have drawn the cities. I've drawn this. I've drawn that. My campaign runs along for 5 years, and at some point I realize, oh crap, rivers don't work like that. Or, you know, what's this glacier doing in the jungle?
This mountain range that looked cool is really
right.
A problem for the story I have.
Right, I need to have a war between these nations, and this mountain range is getting in the way.
And sometimes it can be that the enemies are too far. You play in this area, and you killed all the local noble bad guys, and now you need introduce some new force coming from outside, so you have enemies to fight, so to speak.
Right.
So that can be another
thousands of miles away.
Yeah. And all of a sudden they're popping out of a hole in the ground or whatever it is.
So my old solution for cartographic regrets before I published any campaign settings was erasers, new paper, I just redraw the map, right? And my players, by and large, didn't look at the map except when I showed it to them. So that was fine for the home campaign, and I had made the correction. I felt good about the map again. It only bugged me. once you publish it, you're kind of... You need the big earth-shattering event to justify why did that change. But do you want to talk cartographic regrets a little with respect to shadow?
All right. So some of my issue, if we want to talk about cartographic regrets and things that are still a little too real. Perhaps after you've written something, you have it all planned out, you have a storyline set and ready to go, now you need to make sure you have locations where all these awesome events can take place. So you start sketching your map, and you draw it out, and you get this great idea, and you mark it on the map, and you get another great idea, and you mark it on the map, and so on and so on. And now you realize your map doesn't match your narrative. So, now what? If this happens all in one sitting, then fine, no problem. You can switch one to match the other. What happens if this is the course of a campaign?
Yeah.
And you look back...
18 months later.
Right. Yeah. The next year you look back and you realize, uh-oh, this tower that I've been building up in the background, I don't have the connection for it. There's no reason for them to go there, and now they want to go. So, when you're building your world, you really need to keep kind of these threads in mind of what's going to go where and how the narrative is going to follow your map, how the landscape is going to shape it.
Yes.
And sometimes you start out by building a landscape and then you fill it with interesting places and realms and cities and people call it even cults or whatever it is, and or sometimes the map building is something that you do as a way of noting what happened and as a way of record.
As a historical record.
Yes,
yeah.
So you simply just go with the flow and then reinvent things as the campaign unfolds, and then you kind of, that will become a record. The map will be a simple sketches of what happened. And then you, either way, you can run into trouble, so to speak. And you have rivers that in some, they start 50 miles from a coastline, and then they flow 2,000 miles across the continent, and they end up in the ocean. And then you, after a while, you realize that coastline where the river starts a few miles from has to be like 2,000 feet high or something like that. So you have to, it has to, and it's fun with things that breaks the rules occasionally. You can have one river maybe that flows uphill and maybe one lake, but if they start to have a tendency of having inconsistencies geographically,
the land where
weird.
All rivers flow uphill.
Yeah,
right?
yeah then you start
magic.
Having, yeah, then you start having issues. So to speak.
But it's magic
yeah.
only goes so far, and
yep.
when your players start to notice all of this,
yep.
they start to ask questions, and it
yep.
starts to damage their ability to just follow
yep.
the narrative,
yeah.
to be immersed in the setting.
Yeah. But map making can be interesting either to do to before as a way of planning, prepping, creating a world, or as a way of recording what actually happened. And both ways I've had this pros and cons. So yeah,
right.
The map that I want to draw in some future campaign is one that is almost always from the point of view of the party, right? So like a linear map that just scrolls out like the Bayeux tapestry,
yeah.
and you're always seeing where the heroes are.
Yeah.
I mean, you see this in like the Sioux yeah. account of Little Bighorn, right? It's like, where are our warriors? Where are Custer's
yeah.
guys? And it's just one long map of the heroes were here, the
yeah.
heroes were here, the heroes were here. But nobody draws maps that way.
Yeah. But also, when thinking about that, also avoid these narratives. When I often encounter that when I read what these wonderful creative people write, and simply say, well, we have this 8,000-mile desert. And I realize that, okay, 800 miles. And I realize, well, that's an enormous place. And so they, it sounds wonderful to write it and
right.
say that these, that everything is enormous, gigantic, and spread over. And when you when I start graphically placing that, I realize that what's significant kind of disappears. And if you have to go around it, then you have to invent 10 new kingdoms to just
yeah.
fill it. And otherwise, it doesn't make sense.
Right.
And so you
get
in. Yeah.
Of making sense is right. It bothers you probably more than it bothers the players,
yeah.
right? Like, players only have the perspective on the world that you give them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so...
But it's more of a published problem, because
right,
when you need
right.
to publish a setting, you need to have some sort of map so you can...
It needs to fit on a roughly 24 by 36
then
inch poster.
That's the next big problem. That's the, yeah, then
the constraints of...
Yeah, or printing, especially.
Printing.
Yep.
And, well, I mean, what we saw was most people are doing homebrewing for their own benefit. There were only like 3 or 4 who had published. I guess I didn't ask the question, how many of you would like to publish your homebrew setting? That's a very
yeah.
different question.
Yeah,
yeah.
Get
so
into
that's
it.
Like
yeah.
more like 8 or 9.
Yep.
So let's address that a little bit.
Yeah.
Because that is sort of a topic I can at least say I've succeeded in publishing one setting.
Mm-hmm.
And... So the reality is I get pitches at Cobalt Press from people who say, would you like to publish my world? And the polite answer to that is, we already have one. And it's keeping us plenty busy just supporting one setting.
Right.
The impolite answer to that is, oh my God, no.
What's wrong with you?
It's
yeah.
so much work. I have to love your world to want to publish it. Now, that doesn't mean I would never take someone else's pitched world. But it would need to be like, A, very different from Midgard,
right.
B, clearly have appeal to some audience that's quite distinct, and C, like, be really just ace material, because since I'm not writing it, I'm buying it, I want it to be totally compelling, right? I want the art orders, like, I want to be able to immediately say, what would the cover look like? And have somebody say, oh, well, it would be like this and this. And what are the 3 main races? And how many flavors of elf do you have? Right. So in that way, it's like the best way to get your setting published is to publish it yourself. Because you're the person who's most invested in it. You're probably the only person who knows everything about it. Your players know a lot. But you as the world builder, if you want to print it, we live in a golden age of self-publishing, right? There are tools. There are super talented people like Anna and, honestly, the people of the Cartographers Guild, right?
Yes, exactly. There's probably 100 people that can do absolutely fantastic map, and they're eager to do it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you can convince one of them, hey, this is a really great world, and I can pay you modestly to bring it into reality, to make a map that's publishable, then you're one step closer.
Yeah, then I can give you one advice when it comes to that, because I get pitches probably monthly to do that thing, like map someone's campaign world, and it's awesome. And I usually say that, first of all, I need all the information neatly packaged. Because if I need to read everything you've written about the world, and authors, they simply say, well, I have these 5 books, and it will take me 3 months to go through and annotate it, and if you can pay me for 3 months doing that first, so make all the notes. I want to have, like, sketches of everything, and I want to have neat notes, like each country, what are the features going in that place, etc. Because if I have to go through volumes of stuff, then that will take me 6 months just to go through that. And secondly, be available for questions all the time, because I would start harassing you like crazy, or anyone would be like asking all sorts of stupid questions. What did it look like? What is the color there? What's the vegetation looks like? And this evil spread, is it dry there? Is it wet there? Is it cloudy up on there? Is it active volcanoes? Do we have cracks in there and whatever? What's the coastline look like? Do we have beaches there? And all these kind of crazy things. So there's a lot of these things that you need to think through. And so sketches and easy bullet-pointed list of features in each area, that will be gold mine. If you can send that to someone, then you got my and others interested in my situation. Meaning, that's a possible project. I have way more projects that have gone south or never happened because of lack of coherent notes and sketches rather than money.
Right.
Yep.
I mean, the problem with anyone else publishing your world is, in all probability, there's just a limited market for the number of self-sustaining published worlds, right? Like, Paizo has Galarian, an extremely well-done world, well-supported, lots of fans, they're going to keep producing material for it. They are now, after how many years, thinking of going off-world and saying, all right, we're going to support a second setting, right? So, if a company of that scale does one setting every decade, the market's tiny, and so do-it-yourself is really the way to go. And teaming up with a cartographer first seems like, to me at least, a really great way to start. And then the other thing that I've noticed for campaigns or worlds that have won an audience and acclaim is they tend not to lead with the 300-page world book. They tend to lead with a series of adventures set in the world, right? Like, we were introduced to Greyhawk, some of us older gamers, by Gygax's, you know, Giants and Drow modules.
And Hamlet and Temple of Elemental Evils,
right? Yeah. Okay, so there's a handful of adventures that hint at a much broader world, and everybody liked the adventures, and they wanted to know more about the setting. Yeah. Midgard evolved the same way. I published tiny crowd-funded adventures that had almost no audience called Steam and Brass and Castle Shadowcrag and Blood of the Alchemist, none of which you can find in print anymore. And they were all meant to be drop into any fantasy campaign, and what they led to was, gosh, what's outside this town, right? Eventually, not all that much arm-twisting, said, I'll just use my old campaign and expand on it. It'll be easy. I'll just build a little setting around it. I would recommend to people that starting with adventures would be a great way to start.
Yeah, absolutely. The adventure writing is what really helps you flesh out the narrative direction of where your setting is going to be. Now, naturally, you have to have some idea of what you want to do first.
Yeah, sure.
Like, are you going to be European fantasy? Are you going to go Arabian Nights? Yeah. Are you going
to be sci-fi?
Yeah.
Dragonlance?
Yeah. Right. And so you got to have that general thing sketched out. Yeah.
And adventures also makes it possible for you to release it in chunks. Yeah. So you don't have to publish everything in one go. You can
Everybody
simply concentrate.
I mean, how many of you would prefer to publish it all in one go? right?
One,
you write one
book.
Big world book?
Yeah.
Just
no.
Spit it out that you don't have to write anymore.
It's done, right?
Yeah.
It's never done.
All right.
Don't spill all the beans. Concentrate. Make an awesome adventure path for
yes.
a set of campaign in one area and release
it. Don't tell them how
that.
Aaron and died.
Exactly. And then sketch out the other areas so you have some basic ideas, but keep them to yourself and then hold that in and then map another little bit by the time. That's me trying to promote, so I don't get to do all these enormous projects.
All
like,
at once.
Yeah, exactly.
Right,
like
the Southlands was excessive.
Start with a smaller area.
Yep. So I don't have to work 18 months on one project because that gets tedious after a while.
Right.
Yep.
And when you do adventures or adventure paths or campaigns, you can handle them in, you know, level appropriate chunks
mm-hmm.
and start
yep.
one place and then just sort of build and grow to the other places as you go.
Right. Which sounds easier than it is, right? The adventure path model is the Paizo model, and it works. But there's a huge creative team behind every one of those arcs.
Yeah.
Well, and I use the term. I don't necessarily mean the exact same way that Paizo.
Sure.
I mean, you know, a series of linked adventures.
Yeah.
Right. It could be a three-module thing, right? The old school. It could be those D&D. Strahd books,
campaign books.
Yeah, you could just have a source book up in each area, one by one, so to speak. Rather than having a superficial book of the whole world, you can have a detailed book of each area.
Sort of like the old Known World Gazetteers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh man, if you can reproduce the magic of the Known World Gazetteers, you've got something going on.
Yeah.
Part of the magic for those, of course, is cover art. So where do you source artists? If you want to publish your own setting, part of what you're going to have to think about is what does that cover look like? Because that is supposed to tell the whole story of your entire campaign in one issue.
One snapshot.
Yeah.
Right? Even if you're publishing it in small adventures, that first installment for the first part of the trilogy of adventures has still got to tell a lot about it. Is it what is it? It sounds easy. Like, in your head, you know what your world building is all about. But when somebody says, you only get two figures, because I'm only going to draw two characters and a background, it narrows it down pretty sharply.
Yeah.
And sketches and art description and art brief are a big deal of that. When I was working on the Tyranny of Dragons material for the Realms, I got a bunch of notes from Wizards of the Coast about, well, this is how we see the Sword Coast's architecture. So whatever you put in your art briefs, it needs to have this kind of architecture. I said, okay, I don't think I've ever gotten world-building architecture notes before, but clearly it's a northern climate, and they want this, that, and the other thing, and they're trying to enforce consistency. I thought it was a nice way to get across something immediate about the environment.
That's a nice point.
Right, and it was a nice way to avoid artists having to fix it later,
right? One artist drew it with white marble and the other drew it with wrought iron arches.
Right. So it's like, well, and that's a nice bit of consistency that you can carry through from the beginning. But whatever you're getting in that first cover painting, you're sort of committing your whole setting to supporting that look and feel.
Right.
As a publisher, I obsess about covers for a reason. And if you are self-publishing your world, should probably obsess about your cover too.
So that brings up an important point when you're doing world building, and certainly once you've been at it for a while and you've been ongoing, consistency. People will notice when stuff doesn't match, right? Your players in your game will notice that this was the tone of the campaign 6 months ago when we started, and now we're doing all this kind of stuff over here.
You watch Mad Max Fury Road, and suddenly,
and now,
war boys,
and water was a resource.
Suddenly things change.
Exactly. So there's a way to do that, right? But you have to make sure that you build to those sort of things and that there's no abrupt breaks, suddenly, where this city that we were in that was kind of like medieval London is now, why are we in Baghdad, right? What's happened here? It's very different.
And then keep the art and cartography consistent with the text and the changes of the text, because otherwise people would notice that.
The best way to do this is to pick one artist early to be your go-to artist. Because even if they can only provide so many pieces, they're all going to have a certain similarity of style.
Right, yeah.
I mean, you may not be able to convince multiple artists to work on a project if you don't have, I mean,
We talk about it in the Guide to World Building. Second obligatory reference to the book. We talk about having a Bible, a setting Bible for look and feel, tone, terminology, that you can hand out to other people who are your creative partners, peers, and collaborators.
Sets a baseline.
Yeah, I mean, if you're self-publishing, let's be honest, a huge chunk of the work falls on you to organize it and get it out there. But unless you are remarkably talented, you are not the cartographer, designer, editor, layout person, and interior and cover illustrator. That is at least three people. Does anybody here both draw and do game design? Have you any of those lucky people?
I draw terribly, but...
All right.
Still do it.
Showing some promise. If you can
put that into your setting and you're good.
I mean, we laugh, but if you can do a better sketch, like, I want this guy here and the dragon to be kind of like this, you're telling your artist more than they get from me, who would say, well, I'm just using text to describe what I want.
Sketches don't have to look good to be good. They
to be
effective. Can be,
yeah.
They can be vivid imagery. They can be terrible, so to speak. Just something that I get the relations. This should be supposed to be north of that, and that should be in between, and the road should be on the north side of the river, and there should be a bridge here, and so on and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah, yes. It's like storyboards, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You want a storyboard for your map, you want a storyboard for your cover.
Yep.
If you can provide those underpinnings, then the people you're partnering with are going to give you more of what you want, and you're going to spend less time going around and around saying, no, that's not the thing.
And you will save a lot of time for artists to actually work on what's important and not just finding out what they're supposed to do.
Right. Okay, well, we're talking a lot about like self-publishing and the publishing process. We had a lot of other topics that were not that.
Sure.
Do we want to talk about new continents? Did we want to talk about, religious wars? Oh, I love those.
Hey,
I mean, I don't love those. I mean, they're great for a campaign.
Yeah. Suffering work for your game.
Oh, right, was that the one?
Yep.
Making horrible, endless suffering work for your game. Yeah, let's talk about that. One of the things I occasionally drift into in my world building when I've had a long, gloom-ridden section of, you know, vampires, conquest, and slaughter, is I'll build some idyllic little kingdom that's just charming and nice and boring. And I'll leave it in the campaign just long enough for players to get attached to it.
I like it.
Yeah. This dwarven canton is charming. They produce copper ingots and raise sheep.
And they like you guys.
They like
you
guys.
The goblins.
You're the best.
Yeah, that is time for one of these world-shattering events.
Yeah. It doesn't
have to be
world-shattering.
Kingdom-shattering.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So at that point, it's like, oh, well, the dwarven canton next door has decided that you're all heretics over here. Religious warfare is one way to go with that. Nationalism is another way to go with that.
Yeah.
But building in conflict was one of the early design pegs that we put in for Midgard. We said, we want to stack up dynamite everywhere. It is not your job as the world builder to let it explode. That's the players.
Players decide where to strike the match.
Right. The players decide. That is exactly it.
Yeah.
But one of the fun things about world building for publication or world building for your homebrew is, set the rock so it's almost ready to start the avalanche. Make the situation volatile. Make sure that it's clear heretical priests are coming into the idyllic little canton and preaching horrible nonsense.
Strange new ideas.
Strange new ideas, and then, you know, one day the players wake up and they smell smoke and they go out in the town square and they find a little blackened pillar and a pile of ashes and they say, what happened here? Oh, we burned him.
Yeah?
Well, what do you mean you burned him? Well, you know, you guys are priests of the one true way. Your cleric follows the proper faith, but this neighbor came over and now we had to burn him because he wouldn't stop. There you go. Oh, really?
So building in conflict, I think
building in conflict.
That's the biggest takeaway there is
the whole point of this is adventures, right? We need awesome stories, and your players want awesome things to do so they can go out and be awesome.
They do, yeah. Yes.
So things have to go horrible for them to be able to do that, usually. Unless it's just sort of wandering and sell swords. And
if it's wandering and looting tombs, I think that's great, but you don't need to do a ton of world building for that. Right? You just need an excuse for there to be a lot of tombs, like, this culture fell and collapsed, and their people like to bury their dead with lots of wealth.
Done. Sure, done. So, there's your game. But if you're looking for something more than that, then you have to set up those dominoes to fall.
Yes.
And so when you're planning, making your sketches on where these kingdoms are and how many kingdoms are around the desert so they can skirt around it if they don't want to go across it,
right.
How do those kingdoms feel about each other? Are they allies because they're so close geographically? Are the tensions high because they're packed so close together but have conflicting ideologies?
Yes.
Think about all of that, and that's one of those things where it can be useful to do one of those conspiracy theory webs, where you have pins or a pin board with all of your different nations, and then draw your allies and rivalry lines.
All of your experience in vampire LARPing will come back.
There it is.
Point.
You know what I'm talking about. I'm making a pottery chart.
Yes, exactly.
A hates B. B hates C. C hates A.
This guy owes this guy. This guy is secretly in love with her. There you go.
I think that's a part of world building that is underappreciated. Sort of like basic world building is often, what have I got? Where are the names on the map? Can I convince my cartographer that things are okay? Advanced world building is, who are the players and what are their conflicts?
Yep.
Because at that point, you're setting up the dominoes.
Right.
And you are, in fact, building in the wars and the persecutions and all the horrible suffering that we were...
Or the slow simmer stuff. If you don't want to go all out religious war, burn the heretic. You can have intrigue. You can have espionage. You can have this person said this, or this letter leaked to the wrong king. And
this is why
various corruptions.
Right.
Yeah.
Pick which Pathfinder Ultimate book you want.
There
to
it is.
Touchstone
yes.
for your campaign.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
If it's Ultimate Wilderness, you're going to build one sort of world. If it's Ultimate Intrigue, you're going to build a different sort of world.
Yeah.
Building on the Ultimates thing, look at history. Look at history and literature big time.
Steal from it.
So plunder it. if you want intrigue and poisoning, you want to look at, Renaissance Venice.
Sure.
Right?
Or the Chinese Imperial Court.
There you go.
Yeah.
Anything involving the first four Roman emperors.
There you have it.
Yes.
A horrible time to be a politician, a great time for adventure. Yes. I think we've run more than half our time, and we've hit a bunch of topics. Let's take at least a couple of questions,
because
I feel like we're hitting some of our bugaboos, like me and my elves.
Yeah.
How much of this, what would you say is different between writing a world for gaming and writing a world for writing, like
for
a book?
Fiction?
Yeah.
Very similar.
There's a ton of similarities. I mean... Lord of the Rings, I swear, would have been a gamer's paradise if there had been RPGs in Tolkien's day, right? But instead, that didn't exist, and he said, I'm going to make some novels out of this, and all of his campaign notes we call the Silmarillion, and weren't meant for publication, but they were world-building and fun for him that turned into fiction. So I think the underpinning work is the same. You need to know... something about the history, who are the players, what are the conflicts. The difference is, in gaming, you're setting that all up for other players to participate in.
Right.
In fiction, you need to pick a point of view character, or two or three, depending, and guide the reader through a narrow path through the world. Ultimately, you as the author or designer of the setting still kind of have to know everything, or enough to bring the story to the audience.
I would say there's also a difference if you're world building for a game for you to run yourself versus you're building a setting to publish for other people to run. Because in the one, it can evolve and you know what's going to happen and you can set up and you can knock over whatever dominoes to spur action that you feel are necessary to give the player something to react to and to do.
Right.
If you're building a setting to publish, it has to be more static.
Yeah.
It's going to be set in a book, right? And then you can do sort of meta plot things where you release various stuff to change things up in the future, but that's kind of a separate concern because you have to have everything set up for whoever buys your setting and runs it, for them to grab those things and go with it. And that's a little different than doing it for yourself.
Oh, yeah.
And so the former case where you're writing a game world for you to run, that's where I think it's more similar for writing a game world for you to write in. And the only difference is you don't have four or five, six other players doing the reacting. Your characters are doing the reacting. So, but the initial work in understanding the world, knowing who is where, and what is going to set them off against other people, that's all the same.
Yeah. Human nature is human nature. Yeah. Conflict is
natural. Yeah. So this is going to express my ignorance in some of the, you know, what people have done in world building, but it just occurred to me that it's effectively a world is a set period of time.
Yep.
So in theory, you could have, especially if you're going way back in history, you could have essentially the same world, but it would be totally reasonable to say that 100 years hence, that's a completely different setting. 100 years after that, that's a completely different setting.
Absolutely.
Because in our own world, certainly, thinking of Roman times versus
sure.
Italian history versus whatever,
yep.
that's literally the same, not only the same world, but it's the same country.
Yep.
But it's a completely different
and
world.
And descendants of the same people and the same culture.
Has anybody done that? Where they've essentially have you guys done that? Or thought of doing Midgard plus 50?
Plus 50, plus 100. I don't want to take giant... But there are games that have...
Starfinder's a little bit of an
extreme example.
Extreme example in that direction, but yeah. You know, I've seen some of the more modern world, our world setting games like Onyx Paths, Chronicles of Darkness. Like they recently came out with Dark Eras, which is a giant freaking book talking about everything throughout various eras of human history.
Vampire Dark Ages.
And Vampire Dark Ages and Requiem for Rome. So, you can definitely use time as
any role play that you do in Middle Earth is the same way. You can go in the First Age,
there you go.
Third Age. Each one is vastly
Harry
different
Potter.
In the Mountain Magic.
Very much so. Yeah.
That time is one of the useful dimensions. You have geography, you can move horizontally, or
the
then you can use time to move in another dimension.
Right. So when we talk about world building, we're almost what we mean is setting building.
Yes.
Right? Because the world, you know, it can evolve over a timeline or it's a snapshot.
Right.
People often actually play Harry Potter kind of things in either the regular era, the Marauder era, or Next Generation.
Yeah, there you go.
Right.
Or Star Trek.
Or Star Trek. Yeah.
So when you're doing world building, at least in my experience, I come up with Kingdom A is this way, and Kingdom B is very, very different, and they have to be some distance apart. So what are your strategies when you kind of have to meld from one culture into the other? Because I find that sometimes I have really abrupt things happen, where it's like, yes, we need you to be envoys to Kingdom B. And sort of the intervening geography gets weird.
Yeah.
Kind of goes a little night-day.
I've run into that problem.
You have strategies for dealing.
Yeah, because I usually get notes saying that this is the desert here, and then we have a jungle there. And that sounds awesome in what it does describe it, that chapter and then that chapter. But when you put it on map, I realize that, okay, we have 500 miles of the desert, and then we have that needs to be at least a couple of hundred miles of something in between.
Right.
And as a photographer, then my first escape is simply just sending an email with a note like, what the hell is in between there?
Yeah.
And wait for the answer and then come. And
when
Dan or I
get an email like that saying, what the heck is in between there? I mean, there's two ways to go, right? If it's traditional dwarves here and Japanese samurai elves over there, it's like, either the answer is... Right.
Yeah.
The border elves.
I mean, it's either geographic separation or sometimes it's these two cultures started at points that were widely separated, but as they succeeded and grew, they actually bumped, right? So that their center point of culture A and culture B are some distance apart, Rome and London. And at some point, they decided, we have a border here. This leads back to that whole conflict thing, right? Where it's like, they don't have to be similar. They can hate each other's guts all along the border. I don't think that culture is really a continuum, right? It's like A and B can be wildly different.
You can have hard borders, or you can have soft ones that kind of spread out over time. And,
right.
And you can have geographical. You can invent, if there's no description, I sometimes just invent a mountain chain that will be a natural barrier. And then I see if someone kind of picks on me and say, oh, that's, what the hell do the mountains do there? And then I have to explain that, well, that was a vacuum, so I filled it
with mountains. But the other thing you can fill that vacuum with is border states, right? Those of you who are may remember the Soviet era, all of Eastern Europe was just the buffer, right? Mm-hmm. And Midgard has the same thing, right? There's this dragon empire down here, and there's this thing called the Illyrian Marches. Oh, yeah, and look, the White Mountain Marches. Those are all just buffer states that are, how to put it, loosely controlled puppet states, right? They haven't quite conquered them yet.
They're speed bumps.
They're speed bumps between culture A and culture B. And they're fun from game design perspective because they're like Casablanca, right? Everybody wants something. Everybody wants to keep the external powers happy. One more question. I think we got one waiting in the back for a while. Sorry.
More of a comment, but if you want disparate, you were talking about how edges and centers. If you want disparate cultures right up next to each other, I would say former empires are a good friend. Like, if you want Teutonic knights next to Mongol horsemen, well, maybe in this universe, the Mongol Empire made its way well into Central Europe.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the cultures that sort of export themselves really effectively will invariably bump up against wildly different cultures. I don't know if that addresses your particular example, but it's one way to get there.
Yeah, did we get there? I think we meandered a little bit.
I think we meandered. Okay, got there. The third obligatory reference to the Kobold Guide to World Building. All right. Question.
More of a comment for the gentleman here that brought up the how do you space it? And that's to put trade, the idea of trade and commerce between two areas is a good way to separate but yet bring together, such as silk. Or the Spice Road in the Ottoman Empire, it really created.
Also, think about where everyone gets their food.
Then you can bring in civilization to deserted wildernesses and stuff like that, because there's a reason to cross that wilderness.
Yes,
right.
That's in the middle.
Yeah,
put the mithril mine in the middle.
We have 4 minutes left. We had a question.
We had a question in front.
Just kind of going with disparate cultures and everything. How do you keep one specific culture from being like a stereotype of everybody from nation A has a funny English accent and everyone from nation B has a Chinese accent?
Well, if it's in your home game, I mean, do accents. It doesn't matter, right? If you're going to publish it, then you want to treat that with a lot more care.
Right, but I mean, particularly like trying to keep everybody from a specific area from being not really stereotypical, but almost a cardboard cutout.
This is a tricky one, and it's broader than
getting into a lot of detail.
Interpretation, right?
Yeah.
So everyone's got a base culture, just like everybody's got like a base religion, but how you interpret that is different. Like in Galarian, for example, Sarenrae, she's the goddess of like redemption and healing, but there's an arm of her religion that is all about kill the heretics, right? Burn everything. And that's all the same god, that's all the same worshiper, and that's all the same culture, technically, the culture of the Serenite religion. So you can easily create a culture that's more dynamic just by interpretations of what the cultural norms are. Different people in different areas of that culture are going to interpret the norms differently.
Right.
Perfect.
Yeah. All right, we are wildly running out of time, but I'm taking the last question over here.
And one way, I think, to keep your culture from becoming monodimensional hats is just look at it and think of, okay, what would this mean to be a working civilization? Like, not all dwarves can be miners. You need, some dwarves to be craftspeople to make stuff out of what they mine.
Some dwarves have to be farmers.
You also need some dwarves, to be farmers, merchants, etc. Because dwarves are not rust monsters. They don't eat metal. They
don't eat metal. Hang on.
I mean...
Well, there will be food dependent from the neighboring country or the pesky elves that need to sell them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, one way to keep them all, they may all share the same accent, but they have different roles.
Right.
And different value they bring to their society. So if you just remember, they all have an English accent, but one's a baker.
And just because it's one country, they don't have to all be one people. They could have different states or different, you have different sub-rulers, but then you're getting into some pretty micro detail on your world building.
So yeah, I'd love to talk about provinces,
that's where source books
and fiefdoms,
come in.
And vassalage, and, but that's probably World Building 301. All right. Thank you all for your awesome questions. Come see us at the Cobalt Press booth in the dealer hall if you want to chat more on any particular issue. And I hope you take some of this back home to your own world building and it helps. Thanks for coming.
Thanks very much, everybody.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction Podcast PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage, made possible with the help of Justin Sluder and Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad. To find more great Pathfinder audio, go to NoDirectionPodcast.com.